From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1926 when the Scholastic Aptitude Test, or SAT, was created. The test was first intended to be a way to measure innate intelligence and to do so in a way that favored raw merit, not class or wealth, a level playing field, a way to examine all students equally. But by 1938, the first SAT consultant appeared, promising a way to raise student scores. His name was Stanley Kaplan. Today, Kaplan's company competes with the Princeton Review and dozens of others as part of a test preparation industry that makes $4.5 billion annually. Boosting SAT scores is big business now. And here's the problem. The SAT's become a mess in many ways, starting with the test prep. Wealthier families can afford more test prep, so kids from wealthier families generally perform better on the SAT, even if they don't have very good grades in high school. Curiously, colleges and universities that abandon or optionalize the SAT found that they started to attract better students, not just students who could afford to learn the tricks to do well on one exam. But poor students weren't going to college at all in many cases, even the poorer students who performed well in high school, and let alone performing well on the SAT. Everything that the test was supposed to stand for in 1926 seemed to have eroded into a kind of big business model that didn't do a very good job of predicting college or career success. The question now is whether it's too late to save the SAT. That might sound dramatic, but the list of colleges that no longer requires SAT scores is 20% and growing. And the new leader of the College Board, which creates the SAT, has quickly acknowledged that big changes are needed, and they are coming. Last week, we learned that the SAT will get a major overhaul in 2016. It will return to 1,600 points. The essay will be optional, and most importantly, the test will be designed to reflect classroom learning and critical reasoning. We want to hear from you. Is the SAT still valuable? We invited the College Board to join us today. They declined, but here for the hour is Ian Mortimer, the Vice President for Enrollment Management at Nazareth College. Ian, nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And on the phone for this half hour, Kevin McDonald is a school counselor at Irondequoit High School. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Evan.
Ian, I'm going to start with you here. Let's start right here with this. When did Nazareth College join the ranks of test optional admission schools and why?
It was fall 2006, and the motivating factor was really around access. One of the things that is and was and still is a commitment to the campus community is access. And when we looked at test scores of applicants that we wanted to enroll and compared those to their GPAs and then looked at environments, that just it didn't make sense, and so we went the optional route.
And what year was that again, you said?
2006.
In 2006. Kevin, do you hear from students and parents who are interested more these days in test optional schools?
We are hearing that on a more regular basis, and parents are definitely encouraged to see places like Nazareth and Union College, as well as in our SUNY system, like SUNY Potsdam, those institutions that are offering this as an option.
And give me a sense, Kevin, it's been a couple of decades since I dealt with the SAT. What kind of pressure do students experience in preparing for it?
Well, it's definitely a student-by-student type of anxiety, because for some students, you know, in New York State, they are definitely well-tested, and for some students, testing is never a problem, so those kids may walk into an SAT feeling pretty good, feeling pretty confident. But there's a pool of students that work hard in school and give it their all, but still, like on a Regents exam, they struggle. They might be kids that struggle with anxiety in general, and then when they step into an SAT, you know, they're feeling pretty negative right from the beginning.
263-WXXI, 263-9994, if you'd like to weigh in on SATs. We're going to be talking this hour about some of the changes that will be coming in 2016. But first, I want to talk to Ian just for one second about the fact that I didn't invite Ian from Nazareth, and we're going to hear from Hobart and William Smith later in this hour. We didn't want to only talk about test optional colleges. We don't want to denigrate the 80% of schools that still require SAT scores. Do you talk to colleagues in other schools, and is there more of a discussion? Give me a sense for what your colleagues are saying about this, because you're still in the minority, Ian, at Nazareth, of test optional.
Yeah, I mean, I think the across the peer group of individuals that are in enrollment, you know, it really depends on, I think, the type of institution that you're at.
Mm-hmm.
you know, one of the things that, you know, SATs, I think historically have been very valuable for are the top 100 schools in the country. I mean, it gives them a data point from which they can go through, you know, tens and thousands of applications and make that review process a little easier. And from their perspective, you know, the SAT is an important input, and, you know, it helps them get from 20,000 applicants to, you know, maybe 10,000, and then, you know, kind of, you know, go through the prioritization process from there. The other thing that, the other types of institutions that SATs, I think, are also somewhat important for are schools that have a lot of international applicants. You know, it does provide an input in terms of leveling the playing field, especially when there's, you know, a good amount of corruption at the TOEFL, when students are taking TOEFL, you know, across the world, particularly in China. And so the SAT does become a way to, you know, kind of, again, create the level playing field and help them come to conclusions on apps. I think the thing that, you know, our profile school, which is a very competitive small private, you know, when you're not in the top 100, the SAT doesn't do us much favor, because, you know, we're really trying to find, you know, fit. And fit for us means a lot of different things. You know, at Nazareth, we have very strong music programs, and a portfolio is required. And so, you know, we want students, obviously, who can handle academic rigor. But in terms of prioritizing, you know, within the music program, SATs, you know, may be less, you know, important. And that's another reason we went optional. You know, same with arts. And so, you know, it's not as important for our peer group, or at least, you know, again, speaking for us. And I think the other thing that we're realizing is that, you know, we just have to become more diverse, for economic reasons and for the betterment of society. And as a result, you know, the data shows that it's just not a help to them.
Yeah, the data shows that the top level of SAT is generally richer and whiter.
Yep.
And I believe it was Wake Forest was one of the first top 100 schools who went test optional. And what they found was all of a sudden their incoming classes were more diverse. You're not surprised by that, are you?
Not at all.
Yeah. I want to play a cut if we could. I had a chance to talk to a mother who kind of helped spark this idea for this conversation today. And this is a short conversation, a few minutes, with a mom who named Kathy, whose daughter applied to two schools that were both test optional, but they ran into some difficulty with one of them. So she's going to describe her experience, and we're going to come back and talk to Kevin and Ian about this. Let's listen.
Well, my daughter's a senior graduating and has taken the SAT, of course, in her junior year, and it wasn't a very pleasant experience. You know, they get the kids up at 7:30 on a Saturday to slog through this many hours test, and I just don't think, and nor does my daughter think, it's a good assessment of her college or her high school experience. So it's it wasn't very satisfactory, and she did not take it a second time.
Now, there are a growing list of schools around the country, roughly 20% now, call themselves test optional, that you don't have to submit scores and you will not be penalized for it, or ostensibly you won't. You hope that they will hold true to that. What was your experience?
Well, that was very true in the school that my daughter actually wound up choosing. But in her second choice school, which was test optional, she got a lot of pressure from the admissions counselor to submit her scores, and she really didn't want to. They weren't horrible, but she just felt very strongly that if you're offering test optional, you should give that option. And the admissions counselor basically wrote an email after a lot of back and forth, because there was an interview involved and other more time-consuming things besides just reading a score sheet, and said, oh, if all my admitted kids went this route, it'd be a lot of extra work for me, ha-ha. And it was very telling that she really didn't want my daughter to go that route because it was more work for her, so that was disappointing. I don't know that that's, you know, often the experience, but it was ours.
So, in other words, scores are easier. You know, you don't have to send the scores, but boy, it would be easier for us and might help you, when your daughter was essentially being told before that, don't worry about the scores if you don't want to. It felt like a bit of a bait and switch?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, and she was very passionate in her response to this person and saying, you know, I'm morally and ethically opposed, even though she did take the test, but that was when she was younger and we just didn't really know that there were test optional schools. And she just said, I just don't feel it's a good description of what I can do. And she's a writer, so she was very happy to have written an extra essay or any of that. So I feel like, yeah, it isn't good for the kids who are more of writers than just filling out a sheet.
What we know from research is that the wealthier a family on average, the better chance they'll have to pay for tutors and training for the SAT. And what we also know is that there are little things that students can learn, little tricks that will help them on the exam. And so kids from higher socioeconomic status do better on the exam. And that's been an acknowledged problem. Give me a sense for the pressure for families to decide, do we invest hundreds or even thousands of dollars trying to prep for this test?
Well, you know, my just anecdotal experience is I did not do that, first of all. And I had a friend whose older daughter had gone this route, and she said, I spent $1,000 to raise, my daughter's score was raised 100 points, which is not very much on the SAT. So that stuck in my head as, you know, why put her through this again when I really, math's not her thing, and I just knew it probably wasn't going to make that much of a difference, so I'd rather invest the money in her actual college.
They're now talking about changes to the SAT that will be taking place in 2016, and without seeing exactly what they are you open to the idea that they can make this test better and more representative?
Well, I would say more writing, you know, but I'm wondering if that's really going to be the case, because I think writing can really tell you about what a child is thinking and how they express themselves, if they're capable of expressing themselves. I'm not a math person either, so that part of it, I don't know how you could, you know, make that more descriptive for the kid. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not a big fan of standardized tests, so I don't know that it would really make it that much better.
And lastly, are you seeing other colleges, other universities that are test optional? You described one experience that was rather negative, and we're not going to talk about specifics, but are you seeing a broader range now that are following through on that promise to be test optional, and has your experience changed?
Well, luckily, her first choice accepted her, and she went, so she really only experienced those two schools, the one where it really was definitely not a factor. They didn't care about the tests. They didn't ask for them. And then the one that did. So we had a kind of a good and a not so good experience. So that's that.
All right. So that's our interview with Kathy, a mother whose daughter did choose a test optional school. Kevin McDonald is on the phone with us. He's a school counselor at Irondequoit High School. Kevin, I would hope that most that her experience is an outlier and that most test optional schools are following through with that promise to not put pressure on students.
I would agree. That's unique. I haven't heard of that pressure being put on a student and a family. You know, what we have heard, we hear an increasing amount when admissions people are talking about the way the admissions process takes place. We hear more about the holistic approach to admissions, especially when a school is test optional. You know, so those would be things like the essay and the recommendations and the interview and things like that, along with the transcript, you know, that those things are much more important to them than those things like an SAT. And I haven't heard of that pressure being put on another student.
Ian Mortimer is here as well. He's the Vice President for Enrollment Management at Nazareth College, which is test optional. When you hear her talk about what feels like a bait and switch and her daughter was pressured by a test optional school to submit the test scores anyway, what did you think?
I'm hoping that it's just an outlier in the process and maybe, I mean, I don't think it's reflective of right. You know, test optional schools at all. I mean, in fact, we do this for a very specific reason and really helping families like that. So it doesn't make sense.
Kevin, she also mentioned that she didn't think that the SAT is a good assessment of high school experiences and learning. Do you?
I would say it is. It gets it to about 50% of what high school is about. There's so much more that takes place in high school and that's required to be successful in college than what is assessed on an SAT. You know, we see kids that students here that work very, very hard and have excellent study habits on a regular basis, you know, that are very consistent here in our high school and go on to do great things after here. And a one-day snapshot that an SAT is, it does not offer a very good picture of what they are as a student.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. We'd like to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter at Evan Dawson, on Facebook as well. And we've had some comments from social media already here. I'm curious to hear what our guests this hour think of The ACT, we talked about the SAT because there are changes coming in 2016. Joe on Facebook says, I had both of my daughters take the ACT, which in my opinion is a far superior test. The ACT tests science, and it seems to be a better indicator of overall knowledge. Many colleges will accept the higher of SAT and ACT scores. The SAT's decision to remove hard vocabulary words and advanced math is not what I would consider to be a step forward. When you say test optional, Ian, SAT and ACT included in that, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Any thoughts on the ACT as a measurement?
Yeah. You know, I'm fortunate enough. I have a colleague who was at DePaul University in Chicago, which is the largest Catholic institution in the U.S., and they recently went test optional. And as a part of their process, they actually partnered with the ACT to kind of flush out exactly, you know, some of these challenges that they were seeing, you know, you know, bias towards, you know, high incomes, lack of preparation in city schools in Chicago, as an example. And their analysis actually proved out almost the same storyboard between the SAT and the ACT, that it was much more tied to wealth and socioeconomic status than anything else.
What do you think, Kevin, of the ACT?
We also encourage students to take both, because oftentimes a student will they will be a better ACT test taker than an SAT. It doesn't always happen that way, but we won't know that type of information until after they take the assessment. But we think it carries the same weight as an SAT. Unfortunately, it also carries the same issues as the SAT.
When I talked to Kathy, this mother, she wanted to emphasize a point as well regarding the way universities and colleges look at assessment. And she said that a test optional school not only is making a decision about what matters to them in admissions, but they're also signaling the way they may view assessment in the four or however many years a student is there on campus. Is that a fair comment, Ian?
For us it is. I mean, I can't speak to the mm-hmm. motivation of other institutions that went this route, but I think that it gets lost in the dialogue is that, I mean, really what we're trying to accomplish here are graduation rates mm-hmm. and not necessarily college admission rates. I mean, I think the dialogue nationally is really moving towards graduation as the primary objective rather than just access. And the more that becomes the dialogue, I think what we're going to find is that there's going to be more and more inputs that predict graduation that are completely irrelevant of a lot of the things that we're talking about, things like motivation and ability to overcome obstacles and those pieces. And those are really, really tough to quantify in an exam.
There's an excellent article from the New York Times. It's called The Story Behind the SAT Overhaul, and I've posted it on our Twitter and Facebook pages if our listeners want to check it out. It's long, but it is really well-researched, and it helps to describe exactly why the College Board is making changes to the SAT. Essentially, the new leader of the College Board is the same gentleman who is largely behind some of the movement regarding Common Core. And in his view, that there were very legitimate concerns that the SAT was favoring the upper part of the socioeconomic ladder, and that the test itself was not very reflective of the high school experience. And so there are going to be some changes. I'm going to be reading from some of those changes in a second, but there was also a part of that article that was alarming to me. That article talked about how the essay portion, which came to the SAT in 2005 or 6 or so, in the last 10 years, you can sort of game it. Test preparation companies have figured out that in order to get a higher score on the essay portion of the SAT, you have to write longer answers. There is a connection between longer answers and higher scores. And some companies would teach students, write a practice essay in advance of the SAT, focus on a broad subject, incorporate a few quotes from historical figures such as Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a way to kind of show off. On test day, write close to the same essay, massage it to fit the theme, and your scores go up. They said scores went remarkably higher. You know, if this is true, Kevin, I feel like that's terribly alarming about the quality and the validity of an SAT essay portion. What do you think?
I agree totally. You know, it flies in the face of everything that the SAT is supposed to be. And unfortunately, on the SAT, the essay is required. You know, if we were to back to the ACT, it's an option. It's not required. So to have that much variability in the writing portion of the SAT is definitely concerning.
And when students come to you for ideas or help, I mean, you're not a test preparation company, but
correct.
Are they looking for tricks on what to expect? What's the kind of conversation with high school students these days?
The type of conversation really is, you know, how do I best prepare? I think a lot of times kids, what students are looking for is a better idea, a better way to get familiar with the test. It's not so much tricks that they're looking for. We do, you know, within our district, we do have a quick test prep program that occurs through our community education department that helps kids, you know, with a little bit of cramming beforehand. You know, so we might point them in that direction. But a lot of times it really just comes down to they're looking for some familiarity with the test.
Yeah. Megan on Twitter wants to know, schools like Nazareth that are test optional, how many students are submitting test scores anyway?
We of our class annually, about a third do not submit, and about two-thirds do submit.
And the follow-up question she has is, are they truly not penalized for not submitting?
Absolutely. So every file goes through a very thorough review, and, you know, in situations where we have the SAT, we'll use it as an input, and if not, then we don't, and we look at rigor, we look at success within coursework, we look at the high school from which a student has come from, which is a real good indicator of preparation, not only for us, but I would argue nationally, and then all the other, you know, pieces that go into the file.
Kevin McDonald's on the phone with us for a few more minutes. He's a school counselor at Irondequoit High School. And Kevin, when students come to you, if they talk about test optional, are they concerned that the schools don't really mean it? I mean, do they feel like they may be penalized for not submitting?
A lot of times they're approaching it with kind of a questioning attitude, like, really, these schools exist, and how good are the schools? But when you start mentioning some of the names of schools that are test optional, I mean, they know a lot of the names are, you know, and they know that these colleges are respected, and that's really all they need to hear, and then they start moving forward with planning for applying to a place like that.
Before I let you go, Kevin, I want to get your take on what we're seeing with Khan Academy. And if you haven't heard of Khan Academy, it has become an online sensation with all kinds of lessons and learning online featured in mass media across the country now. Khan Academy, very, very popular. And the College Board is partnering with Khan Academy to offer what will be free test prep for the SAT. You know, I think it's going to start now, but the new SAT debuts in 2016. Khan Academy is trying to make this more, I mean, it sounds to me like it's going to be more egalitarian, that this will be the best test prep. And as Mr. Khan himself said, this isn't about giving you free test prep if you can't afford better. They're going to try to offer the best test prep possible for the SAT, and it will be free to everyone. Kevin, does that take a step toward taking away some of those barriers for the stratification in socioeconomics when we see the scores?
I think it's a step in the right direction. You know, and I would encourage anybody. Right now, I was looking at the Khan Academy website, and they've already started with some SAT prep for the current SAT. So I would encourage anybody to look on their website now. So I would say it's a step in the right direction.
Ian, what do you think about the Khan Academy's involvement?
I think it's, you know, wonderful. I think there's, to me, that's the real headline in this. You know, as we were talking earlier, you know, one of the things that's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out is as high school students are going to be arriving at college campuses with experience in online learning, what that's going to do to their expectations when they arrive. You know, right now, the K-12 market does not do a lot of asynchronous, you know, online learning. And if Khan Academy is as successful as they think they want to be and how the College Board wants them to be, it's going to really change the dynamic from which students are arriving on campuses with, a whole different set of expectations of what that learning experience and process is going to look like.
All right, Kevin, last question, and we'll let you go here. Do you get the sense that as much as we may see more schools follow Nazareth, Hobart, William Smith, and others in being test optional, and as much as we may see some opprobrium about the SAT, those kind of standardized tests are probably here to stay, and students are at least best prepped to try to do the best they can with it? I mean, do you expect 10, 20 years from now we'll still see these kind of tests?
Oh, I believe we will. I mean, there's colleges that are receiving, you know, 20 and 30,000 applications per year, and to weed through that huge amount of applications, there needs to be, you know, for a lot of them, there needs to be some other data that needs to enter into the picture.
Thanks for taking the time for us today, Kevin. I know it's a busy schedule for you guys, and we appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Evan. Thanks for having this as a topic.
All right, that's Kevin McDonald, a counselor at Irondequoit High School, talking about the high school experience. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come right back. We've been talking to Ian Mortimer, the Vice President for Enrollment Management at Nazareth College. He's here, and we're also going to talk to John Young, the Director of Admissions at Hobart and William Smith. It's another test optional school, changes in the SAT, and what you need to know here on a Monday afternoon at Connections on member-supported public radio.
47 years ago.
WXXI invites you to participate in a nationwide initiative celebrating the 150th anniversary year of the Gettysburg Address.
Of the people,
by the people,
for the people.
Log on to WXXI.org/the address to listen to celebrity readings and contribute your own videos. And be sure to join WXXI TV on April 15th for the premiere of Ken Burns' The Address.
Welcome back to Connections. Evan Dawson on this Monday afternoon. Changes coming to the SAT. You might have seen the headline last week that starting in 2016, they'll go back to 1,600 points and some pretty significant shifts in the way the questions will be presented. We're going to get into that in just a moment, but let's bring in John Young, who's on the phone with us from Hobart and William Smith Colleges. He is the Director of Admissions. Good afternoon, John.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
You guys have been test optional for how long and why, John?
We've been test optional for 7 years now, and when we made the initial decision back in 2006, like Nazareth, was really designed to broaden our applicant pool. We saw many students who were anecdotally saying they weren't applying because they were seeing our average SAT scores. They didn't have those numbers and thought that we wouldn't be paying attention to the other elements of their application.
What's been the impact of that change?
For us, it's definitely broadened the socioeconomics of our applicant pool. We have many more students in our pool that are first-generation college students than before, different ethnicities represented that weren't represented before. It's been a real positive move for us.
How many students who apply to Hobart and William Smith Colleges choose not to submit their test scores?
Right now, it's just under 50% do not submit. Just over 50% choose to submit their standardized test scores.
Okay. And John, earlier in the hour, we heard from a mother who had a kind of a negative experience, not with your school, but with a different school that was test optional. And she said they still pressured her daughter to submit the scores anyway, saying it would be easier for everybody if she just did. And I think based on our conversations this hour, that sounds like an outlier. But I imagine you find that quite problematic if you'd ever were to see that.
Absolutely. To me, I think the challenge, what we're seeing now, is more and more schools, colleges, are becoming test optional, but that doesn't mean they're standardized test optional. It means they want you to submit something else. So there's some schools that might be SAT optional, but will require you to submit other exam scores or other things. And sometimes I can see why an admissions officer might say something like that. That's not a good thing for them to say, but I could see why they would.
Question from a listener for both Ian and John regarding homeschool students. Is the admission process different for them, and how often do you see? I'll start with Ian. How often do you see homeschool students apply?
It is a little bit different just because the credentials are oftentimes different. And when we do get a homeschool application, you know, we really try and make it as personal a process as possible. For really two benefits. One, the benefit of us getting to understand the student, and then also allowing the student to kind of get more of an in-depth look at the college because of, you know, the curriculum. You know, sometimes it's more important for them to know exactly which courses they'll be taking at Nazareth, et cetera. So, you know, that's kind of our background. We don't get a ton of homeschooled apps, but when we do, we just try and make it really, really personal.
And Ian, are they penalized at all for being homeschooled?
Absolutely not. No.
John, same questions for you.
Sure. We encourage all of our homeschooled students to have an interview with us. We encourage anyone to have an interview, but homeschooled students in particular, so that we can get to know them better, exactly as Ian said. A lot of times they don't present the same documentation that a student from a traditional high school background would. so it can be a little more challenging to evaluate their application. But that interview is immensely helpful to us.
You can continue to submit comments and questions via social media or call 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We've got John Young, the Director of Admissions for Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and from Nazareth College, Ian Mortimer, who is the Vice President for Enrollment Management. We're talking about changes coming to the SATs, why their individual schools are test optional, and whether that might change. And so what I want to do is I want to read a chunk here from what is going to change with the SAT. The College Board has made some rather significant changes to what students will have to deal with the test starting in spring 2016. And here it is from the New York Times article on the subject that we've posted on our various social media sites. Quote, starting in spring 2016, students will take a new SAT, a three-hour exam scored on the old 1600-point system with an optional essay scored separately. Evidence-based reading and writing will replace the current sections on reading and writing. It will use as its source materials pieces of writing from science articles to historical documents to literature excerpts, which research suggests are important for educated Americans to know and understand deeply. Quote, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Federalist Papers, Mr. Coleman said, have managed to inspire an enduring great conversation about freedom, justice, human dignity in this country and the world. Therefore, every SAT will contain a passage from either a founding document or from a text, such as Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, that is part of the great global conversation that the founding documents inspired. So now, that's the end quote. And what they're saying there is that the SAT, as it's currently constructed, is so unpredictable that it creates anxiety, and it doesn't really reflect the world and that kind of students will experience later. You know, you don't go to work and show up and have no clue what your assignment might be that day, but you might show up for the SATs and have no clue what a reading source material will be. Now you're getting more of a sense, and they're focusing on more of a core of materials. Ian, I'll start with you. When you read about some of these changes, I don't know how to ask it other than to say, do you view that as a positive, and could Nazareth ever move back to test required, SAT scores required?
Absolutely. I mean, we would assess it, you know, as it became live.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hopeful that it improves. The premise of kind of a one size, you know, fits all, you know, preparatory assessment, it doesn't feel like it deserves the weight that a lot of the whole, full portfolio of work deserves. With that being said, you know, if it does prove out to be, you know, non-discriminatory and really truly reflective of, you know, not only what a student, you know, learns, but also their behaviors in terms of viewing themselves as a student, they're motivated as a learner. You know, those are the things that are really, really predictable and important for colleges in terms of success. Then it's a different ball game. But, I mean, I think there's a lot of work to be done between now and when it goes live to really, you know, flush out if it's going to drastically improve what we have.
And again, the article I'm talking about is a lengthy one, but really very helpfully descriptive of the changes coming to the SATs starting in spring 2016. We've posted them online. And here's another quote from the article. Mr. Coleman, who's leading the changes, said, quote, whenever a question really matters in college or career, it is not enough just to give an answer. The crucial next step is to support your answer with evidence, which allows insight into what the student actually knows. And this change means a lot for the work students do to prepare for the exam. No longer will it be good enough to focus on tricks and trying to eliminate answer choices. We are not interested in students just picking an answer, but justifying their answers, as they will do on the new SATs. John Young, what are your thoughts on what we're reading about the proposed changes in the SATs?
I think they're exciting changes. It certainly would reflect a whole lot more what college life is like and what the work students are doing in college is like, and what they're doing in high school, for that matter. I do think there's the big question, and I read the article you're referring to. I think it's a great article. The big question is, how is that going to be assessed? How are people going to grade that section of the SAT? How will we know that it's not going to fall into the same trap that the SA section on the current SAT is falling into right now?
And you're sort of touching on this now, but could you see Hobart and William Smith ever shifting and changing its status away from test optional?
I'd never say never, but I'd be surprised. I think we have found when we went test optional, we knew that there were some students for whom the SAT scores were just not good predictors of their success in college. and we weren't using them even when we did require tests. There were some students where we knew those just aren't going to help us in our application review, and we would spend much more time looking at their transcripts, their recommendations, other elements of the application. And I think we can make a very good decision without the standardized test scores that are there. I don't think that would change. On the other hand, any data you can use that will help you get to know a student better is always something I'd like to see.
We're going to get to some questions on social media, and if you want to call in, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. A lot of comments on our Twitter feed this hour about Common Core. And again, we've got Ian Mortimer from Nazareth College, John Young from Hobart and William Smith. They didn't create the Common Core. It's important to point that out. But I, you know, it's not very popular right now. I think the implementation, everyone agrees, is not very popular. The question is, with better implementation, will the actual core of learning be largely kept and preserved and improved upon? Because the gentleman who is in charge at the College Board of making big changes to the SATs is also really the chief proponent and the creator of the Common Core standards. Ian, I'll start with you. Do you think that's going to hamper some of the public perception of the new SAT when they see Common Core next to it?
Boy, that's a tough one. I think it will. I think it'll immediately create a bias for, you know, someone who's well-informed on both topics. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm not entirely sure how they're directly connected at this point,
right.
And so that would be something that we'd want to take a look at and see kind of what the commonalities are, or if they indeed are truly two different projects. The Common Core is still, in my mind, a really unknown type of, its value or its risk and its benefits. As you said, the implementation has been the challenging piece for most individuals, and we'll have to wait and see.
And John, how closely are you following the Common Core situation?
Probably more than most, as the parent of a sixth grader and a fourth grader.
Mm-hmm.
I see it every day, and I know I'm challenged, and as are a lot of my friends who are parents, to actually be able to help your own kids when it comes to helping them with their math homework and other things, because things are being taught in such a different way than what we're used to. The theory and the philosophy behind it makes perfect sense, and I can see in the end how the goals and objectives will be very positive. But again, the devil can be in the details, and how all this is executed is very important.
David, listening online, says, I'm one of the few who will defend the SAT, apparently. My son did well, and I'd like these gentlemen to explain that if they don't care about test scores, how do you truly measure students? What are the top criteria at Nazareth and Hobart William Smith? So, obviously, he's defending the SAT, and I understand that, but I'll start with Ian. His question is, what are the top criteria, if not an SAT test score?
So one of the steps that we went through just to, you know, validate that our decision was the right one was to take a look at SAT scores and correlate them with first-year GPA and graduation rates. And so it wasn't a blind decision. I mean, it was a decision that was really backed on data, and we couldn't see any difference between the score, the value of the score, and their success. For certain institutions, it is a viable and important part of the process, primarily with schools that have large volumes. And, you know, I think congratulations to this person's son for doing so
sure.
Well. But when we look at our whole population, we just see too many situations from which it doesn't prove out their value as a student and their value as a learner. And so it was a real, individual decision for Nazareth, and that's why.
And he's asking then, what are the top criteria, if not the test scores?
I mean, rigor of high school, the transcript is first and foremost the most important predictor of success for us. And then also we look at the high school from which they're coming from, and that is very predictive for us in terms of their preparation. And so when we see an applicant, even if, they're not hitting all of our benchmarks, but they're coming from an institution that historically at Nazareth is producing high-quality students. That becomes an important input into the process. We also, like Hobart and William Smith, we want to find a student that has a like fit, academically, emotionally. They have a passion for, who we are and what we represent in the culture, and those are really important as well.
John, Ian answered that question in sort of in two prongs, and I think that was very helpful. So let's start with the way he started that answer was why, or the way you evaluate whether it's a good idea to go test optional, and how did you guys feel confident at Hobart and William Smith Colleges that going test optional was the right decision?
Sure. We did a lot of homework like Nazareth as well. I do think for us, we spent a lot of time working with our faculty, and I remember going to the faculty meeting to present the proposal that we'd be test optional. And what was terrific was one of our most valuable and accomplished faculty members at the time got up in the room and said, I did not score very well on my SATs to the point where I wonder if I would have applied to Hobart and William Smith. Given my background and given my performance. But I would like to think she would have been a student we would have loved to have had here. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those personal stories end up playing a big role in how colleges make decisions. For us, there's no question that the high school GPA, the grade point average of a student in their 4 years of school, is a much stronger predictor of their performance here than an SAT score is. But given the question, there are some students for whom an SAT score is very predictive of their performance. And while we are test optional, we're not anti-SAT. There are some students for whom the SAT is a terrific predictor. But usually there are other elements of the application that line up with those scores. And you can see it when you review a file.
You were nodding there, Ian.
Yeah, I think that's well said, is that, you know, we shouldn't put, just like the SAT is bad, we would never say that. It for certain students, it does reflect their learning and their outcomes. It's just we want to, you know, hedge against the risk of students that, you know, it would work against them. So
we're going to get to the phones in just a second. I think actually we've got Maggie in Rochester on. You're on with Ian Mortimer, who is with Nazareth College. And I want to get Ian's title right because I don't want to promote you or demote you, Ian. You are the Vice President for Enrollment Management. Is that correct?
That's correct, okay, yeah. So the title sounds much more important than it is.
John Young is the Director of Admissions at Hobart and William Smith. Maggie in Rochester, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. It seems to me that relying on the high school that the kids come from is just as socially predictive as far as you know, economic class as the SATs. Would you speak to that, please?
Sure, absolutely. So I made the comment, and so one of the things that we do is that we try and take a deep dive on all of the high schools, or as many as we can, from which we get students. And we use that as a barometer to figure out at what threshold does a student have to be within that high school to have a good chance of graduating from Nazareth. And so when we see a high school that is new, you know, we do the due diligence of really trying to understand, you know, all the curricular pieces to the high school, you know, where are they sending their students if they're regional, or can students from that high school typically move away from home with confidence? And you're absolutely right. I mean, it becomes, you know, just an input that we can use to make a better judgment. You know, I think one of the things that we've learned is that, especially within environments that are particularly, you know, lower socioeconomic, the high school experience can be a real positive in terms of their ability to be successful. We have a partnership with a school down in Brooklyn called Medgar Evers. And, you know, these students are the poorest of the poor, you know, within the city. But their culture and the way that they educate their students go all over the country. They're incredibly well prepared for college. But their SAT scores would be, you know, at the 20th percentile compared to other students. And so when we look at high school, you know, that would be an example from which we need to understand, you know, the culture, the climate, you know, what are the students learning, how successful are they not only, you know, at Nazareth historically, but where else are they going? And that becomes an input into the process.
Well, I was wondering how much effort do you put into assessing students who come from like, you know, a city school, who you just don't expect to see the same things, I guess, as you would from a kid from Pittsburgh. So how do you determine the potential for these children?
And Maggie, are you concerned that kids from those schools might be penalized?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Meg. And Ian, go ahead, and then we'll have John jump in as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly what we want to do, is we want to understand that, you know, we don't want to discriminate against a student because they're coming from that high school. But if they're at the top of that, from that high school, we just want to understand, you know, exactly what the learning experiences have been. So the role of understanding the high school is just kind of a catalyst for us to learn more. And then if we do have a decent number of students who have come from that school, looking historically and seeing how prepared they have been. You know, your question's a good one, and I just want to reinforce that we don't use it as a way to, you know, say no, even though they may look good on paper, I'm sorry, you're not prepared. It's really a way for us to understand, for those who on paper look prepared, you know, how do we ensure that they're ready for college work, and more importantly, that they graduate. And I just want to reinforce, you know, I think that's part of the conversation that, you know, regionally and nationally that this needs to go to, is that the college admissions process is step one of a multi-step process, and that graduation rates is what we're all going to be held accountable to, and we need to start looking in that direction.
We're going to get to David in Rochester on the phone in just a second, but John, can you, short answer, jump in regarding high schools? You know, it's funny because when Maggie was calling, I had a comment online from Christina. I think the high school comment touched a nerve a little, or might have been misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Christina online was asking, do you keep a list privately ranking high schools in the region, and would you publish that list? John, how would you answer it?
No, we don't keep – I don't know of any college that does keep a list like that. But I do think, as Ian pointed out, the issue really is less about where a student goes to high school, because they, quite honestly, don't have much choice in that for most students. But did they take advantage of what that high school had to offer? Every school will have a different profile. And if we don't know a high school, we've got a lot of data at our disposal and some information that we can learn to find out what the curriculum is like, what opportunities do students have to take different courses, and do they take advantage of what that school offers. And that certainly is a very good indicator for us about their success at school.
Go ahead, Ian.
I was going to add a point. And so an example would be, you know, a B student from, say, as a school like Brighton. You know, if we didn't know that Brighton was as high quality as it is, you know, then we would, you know, look at that applicant in a different light than an A student from a school that we knew nothing about. And so knowing that Brighton, as an example, is such a highly rigorous, you know, place that does well, a B student can probably do well, you know, at a place like Nazareth if they're taking the best curriculum and the best courses.
David in Rochester, thanks for calling Connections.
Yeah, well, my point on that was just simply that the comment, if taken literally, about the school from which a person comes from has some predictive merit in how they're going to do, takes away the individuality of that person, such as in a city school district who's taken honors courses all the way through, AP perhaps all the way through, is functioning extremely well, has straight A's, and that person, I think you're saying, would be at a disadvantage when, in fact, they have been in that environment, which may not have a very good reputation, but the individual coming from it is doing exceptional. Your comments, please.
Yeah, it's actually the exact opposite. I mean, if a student is, you know, from the City School of Rochester, you know, in the top 10% of their class, in fact, we incentivize them to attend Nazareth through a very generous scholarship programs. That's, you know, those aren't the students that we want to do everything we can to encourage them to enroll at Nazareth. The point I was trying to make is the, you know, when a student may, you know, not have straight A's, but they're coming from a rigorous place, that we know that they're probably in an environment that is so competitive, but they're still good students and they can still, you know, be successful. That was the input that I was speaking to.
David, does that satisfy you?
That's fine.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. And I think that I understand the confusion on this point. So is it fair to say students from certain districts wouldn't be penalized if you're at the top of your class, but you're a student in a certain district, you're not going to be penalized. But if you're in the middle of your class and you're in a different district, but that district has a very rigorous reputation and has a history of producing talented students with good careers, that maybe you're going to – you have a better chance of being heard or open-minded.
We would look at those files in a different way. Exactly right.
John, same kind of approach there?
I think the key point is that it is important for every college admission staff to get to know high schools from where their students are coming and understand them well, so that when they read an application, they can put those students in the context of their high school. And that's vital. And as I said before, it's much more about did a student take advantage of what their school had to offer, whether that's 27 AP courses and a bunch of honors courses, or a school that doesn't offer as many, but students took advantage of what was offered. That's really the important piece for us.
All right. Wrapping up here in just a couple of minutes here with Ian and John talking about admissions and the new SATs that are coming. To your point earlier, Ian, we don't know what the new SAT will look like until it's here. We're hearing some philosophical changes in approach and whatnot. But to me, it sounds like that they will continue to try to improve the test, which is probably a good thing. But it does sound like especially smaller schools are just more in tune with a more rigorous admissions process. More thorough of evaluation and a broader evaluation, even if that's more work for you. It looks to me like schools like Hobart and William Smith and Nazareth are willing to do it, and maybe that's the future of admissions. Fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we get 5,000 apps a year, and we go through them at an individual basis and try to understand the candidate from all different perspectives, and we can do that, and so the test becomes less important.
5,000 applicants a year for you?
Mm-hmm.
John, how many applicants a year for you?
Same number, just over 5,000.
Yeah, and the future of admissions looks like what, do you think, at Hobart and William Smith?
Increasingly challenging, but as Ian mentioned, all the more reason for us to be thorough as we read all these applications and take advantage of every piece of information we can get, whether that's quantitative or qualitative, when we're trying to assess the quality of a student.
And last comment, John, when you read the piece on Mr. Coleman and the College Board and the new SAT, were you encouraged by it?
I would say I'm cautiously optimistic, and as Ian mentioned, I think the thing that's important is how will the SAT help us predict graduation rates, not just first-year performance, as it currently purports to do.
Cautiously optimistic, Ian, good phrase there.
I think it's absolutely appropriate.
Yeah, well, you guys agree on just about everything. It's nice to have John Young from Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Thanks for taking the time, John.
My pleasure.
Ian Mortimer from Nazareth, and thank you as well for spending the hour in studio with us, Ian.
Thanks a lot.
Important issue, and thank you for weighing in for us. If you were on the line, we couldn't get you at the end of the hour. I apologize. Just kind of got slammed with a lot of feedback there, but that's a good thing, and we appreciate all the great feedback this hour. It's been a great Monday afternoon with you here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll see you tomorrow, and my thanks to the man behind the glass, Dave Campo, as well, here on this Monday afternoon.